To a new online effort, you no longer need a contractor to build a house. Advances in technology and a bit of architectural activism have led to something called the WikiHouse Project. It makes digital blueprints available to anyone for free online, and amateur builders use computer-cut plywood pieces that fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. John Kalish reports the results can be a livable home.
Last fall, New York City saw something akin to an old-fashioned barn raising.
Hang on.
It happened at Maker Faire, an annual event that celebrates the do-it-yourself aesthetic in general and digital fabrication in particular. Using wooden mallets that were cut out of plywood, a crew of eight banged together the slotted frame members of a WikiHouse without a single nail. The WikiHouse project was founded in London a little more than 2 years ago by Alistair Parvin.
Now we're on the roll, it goes very quickly, and it's always like that. Suddenly it starts to look like a house for the first time.
The WikiHouse team assembled two houses at Maker Faire. This one was 12 feet wide, 26 feet long, and nearly 10 feet high. Nick Iridiakanu is an architect who's part of the London WikiHouse team.
It took eight people 2 days to put this thing up. No one, I would say, here is a professional builder of buildings. And also, when everyone came together at the beginning of this process, no one knew the system. They'd never done it before.
They used 3D modeling software to design the houses and direct a robotic power tool called a CNC router to cut parts out of sheets of plywood. The free designs can be customized with computer-aided design or CAD software. Some CAD software has a rather steep learning curve, but SketchUp, a program popular with woodworkers and architects, is simple enough for kids to learn, says SketchUp's product manager, John Backus.
I teach it to third graders, and they do just great. They make models of doghouses and forts they want to build in the backyard and all that kind of stuff.
Two slightly older students in Denver, Colorado, use 3D modeling software to design their WikiHouse.
For an architecture student, I really believe you need to know how to build something.
Lacey Williams is a third-year architecture student at the University of Colorado. She and her boyfriend spent $5,000 building a WikiHouse to live in during a semester-long field project in Utah.
And for us to be able to learn this alternative style of building, it was invaluable.
Williams and her partner built a 150-square-foot shelter they call the Found House. They used discarded building material and bought sheets of plywood they cut on a CNC router. It took more than an hour to cut each sheet.
It's a 3D puzzle. It's a little more difficult than a jigsaw puzzle, obviously, but it's definitely something that, with enough time, you can figure it out.
There's a long history of ordinary people building their own homes. In the first half of the 20th century, Sears, Montgomery Ward, and other companies sold more than 250,000 kit homes.
It was the average man and woman who put these homes together, and they'd often invite friends and family, not unlike a barn raising. Sears promised that a man of average abilities could have one of these houses built in about 90 days.
Rosemary Thornton wrote a book about the Sears kit homes.
Each kit home had about 12,000 pieces of house and came with a 75-page instruction book, and the mortgage application was just two questions. One, do you own the lot on which you intend to build? And two, do you have a vocation? It didn't matter what color or race or creed you were. It didn't matter what your last name was. You got a mortgage. It was just such an opportunity for people that didn't have opportunity. It really did change the face of America.
The WikiHouse may not become the kit home of the 21st century, but it is filling a need. In Christchurch, New Zealand, the scene of a devastating earthquake in 2011, the WikiHouse team is designing a structure that is earthquake resistant. In Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, where the slums known as favelas are crowded and land is at a premium, another WikiHouse group is gearing up to build 2- and 3-story homes. WikiHouse founder Alistair Parvin says that's just what he hoped for.
The aim is to make it possible for anybody to get access to design knowledge, even if they don't have a lot of construction skills, don't have an awful lot of money, and get a house which is actually suited to where they are, not just a kind of one-size-fits-all house.
For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.
Avalanches in Colorado and Idaho killed 3 people over the weekend. It's part of a growing death toll. A total of 15 skiers, hikers, snowboarders, and snowmobilers have now died in U.S. avalanches since Christmas. Now, a rescue technology that's been used in Europe for more than a decade is finally gaining wider acceptance in the United States. Avalanche airbags. NPR's Ted Robbins reports on skis.
So let's say you're skiing the backcountry, which I am most definitely not doing here in Utah, but you get the picture. You're looking for some powder, a thrill. Instead, you trigger an avalanche.
Pretty much as soon as you see that snow start to move, know you're going to get caught, see it coming towards you. No hesitation, just pull the trigger.
Andy Wenberg yanks the cord, inflating the airbags in his backpack. They come out like wings. Wenberg is with Backcountry Access, one of several companies making airbags. We're on solid ground, but if we were in an avalanche, he says the backpack would keep him close to the surface and easier to dig out.
And the whole idea is when you deploy that thing in an avalanche, you're eliminating burial depth.
They look something like car airbags, but they work on an entirely different principle. Car airbags lessen injury by stopping you from crashing into the dashboard. Avalanche airbags don't stop you from crashing at all. They keep you safe simply by turning you into a larger object.
And larger objects rise to the top of avalanche debris.
Bruce Tremper of the Utah Avalanche Center says it's about the physics of granular flow.
Take a bag of tortilla chips, and of course you want the big pieces, not the little crumbs. And so you shake the bag up and down, and the big pieces come to the surface. I mean, most everybody knows that.
Geologists noticed that big trees and big rocks rose to the surface in avalanches. So why not make people bigger? One reason avalanche airbags have been slow to catch on in the U.S. is because the TSA doesn't allow passengers to fly with the canisters used to inflate the airbags. Ski resorts and backcountry guides are beginning to keep canisters on hand so people don't have to fly with them. Amy Engerbretson is a professional skier. She says she wears an airbag backpack whenever she skis into the backcountry. She needed it a couple of months ago near Alta, Utah.
I made my turn, and very quickly after I made my turn, I felt the snow shift under my feet, and then I saw cracks visibly shoot everywhere. And at that moment, I immediately reached up and released my airbag.
The next thing she knew, she was being carried along. She came to rest at the bottom of a gully under 2 feet of heavy snow.
Obviously, it's scary, but without an airbag, I probably would have been like 5 to 7 feet deep, which is a very dangerous burial depth.
Instead, rescuers used beacons and probes to find her and dig her out in less than 5 minutes. Bruce Tremper of the Utah Avalanche Center says if every backcountry skier, snowboarder, or snowmobiler wore them,
they would probably save about half the people who would otherwise have died in avalanches. So they'd work pretty well.
Avalanche airbags can cost more than $1,000, but that's not what you're thinking about when a wall of snow rushes at you. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
Termites don't have a very good reputation. They conjure images of terrifying wood-munching insects that can take down a house. But in Africa and Australia, termites are better known for their feats of construction rather than destruction. Termite colonies can build huge, elaborate mounds that rise up from the ground like insect skyscrapers. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce tells us, scientists recently took some lessons from termites to design a team of robot construction workers.
Some insects are good at building things. Think of a wasp's nest or an underground labyrinth of ant tunnels. But Justin Werfel says those insect homes are nothing compared to a big termite mound.
Termites are the real masters of construction in the insect world. The largest termite mound on record was 42 feet tall.
He says each mound has a complicated network of tunnels inside. The overall shape of the mound depends on the species.
Some of them have an open chimney in the center, and hot air can come rising out of that. Some of them are closed mounds. There are what are called cathedral mounds. They have all these elaborate ridges on the outside, like flying buttresses.
Millions of insects work together to build these complex, large-scale structures by doing stuff like pushing bits of mud around. And yet, they're not following a blueprint or listening to orders from some termite supervisor. Instead, they seem to sense what's around them and apply some simple rules to decide what to do next. That's what inspired Werfel and his colleagues at Harvard University to create robot termites.
We've created this system of multiple independent robots that build things we ask for. And they do it more like the way insects act than the way that robots normally act.
The robots don't look like termites. They look more like black mechanical beetles. They're about 8 inches long. They have just a few onboard sensors that let them navigate around a worksite set up in a lab. Each robot can grab a specially designed square brick, carry it on its back, and then set it down. Werfel says that he and his team programmed the robots to follow some simple rules.
They build things that are much larger than themselves. They climb on what they're working on building to get to higher places. And they coordinate what they're doing using a tool that termites use. Rather than talk to one another directly, they coordinate indirectly by changing their shared environment. So one puts down some material, another one comes along and reacts to that material and uses that to help it decide later whether to put more material down.
The termite-inspired robots are described in the journal Science. Researchers show how programming the robots to follow different sets of rules can produce a variety of structures, from castles to pyramids. So far, the robots have only made modest structures, and they do it slowly. For example, they built one that's shaped like a trident.
And that involves only 8 bricks, and that takes half an hour.
The vision is that someday, swarms of robots could stack up sandbags to protect against flooding, or go to Mars and build living quarters for astronauts. That's still a long way off. But this study is a proof of principle that robots can work together like termites to build complex structures. And Hod Lipson says that's a big deal. He's an engineer at Cornell University who specializes in robotics.
It's one of these things where, okay, the idea has been around for a while, that you can have robots cooperate to construct something larger than themselves. But no one has really been able to get that to work. And it's not because of any specific detail, but it's sort of coordinating everything together.
He thinks this study opens up a lot of new possibilities for thinking about how to use machines as builders in the future. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You may remember that last week we spoke with organizers of a hackathon in Oakland, California. It was a gathering of developers who were asked to consider ideas for, say, a smartphone app that could have saved Trayvon Martin or perhaps solve other social problems. But the bigger question was how to get young black males into tech careers along with other people who might not usually find a seat at the table. Galima Pryforce is back with us. He is co-founder of Kino Labs. He helped launch Startup Weekend Oakland, Black Male Achievement, and we decided we wanted to check back in with him again, so we called him in San Francisco. Welcome back. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to ask how things went, but I'd want to pick up where we left off. And in our conversation, you made a statement that I think might have surprised and disturbed some people. You said that a lot of people at these big Silicon Valley companies just aren't comfortable working with young black men, and they told you that. And why is that?
It's very interesting. So we definitely had gotten those emails. I definitely got those emails. I think that it has a lot to do with their own sort of their own biases as it relates to interacting with people who don't look like them, and so there's the sort of racial, ethnic side to it, but there's also the issues side to it. I don't know what are the issues or concerns of young black males, and so I don't feel comfortable building anything related to those issues.
So what happened? I mean, did you get the turnout that you hoped for? What was it like?
It was an overwhelming success. When we thought we would get 150 people, and if it was a rainy weekend that weekend. There was rain all over the place, and thank goodness that California got that rain. But we thought we would get 150. We planned for 150. We got 200. For our Saturday evening Yesweco Gala, we thought we were going to get 300 people, and we ended up getting 400 people. I mean, and that was the theme. The theme was that this hackathon was so much in demand that people really showed up, and that was really exciting.
Well, it's interesting, because so maybe those perceptions and reality were not the same at all. So tell us, what are some of the ideas that came out of it? What was exciting to you?
So there were some really amazing ideas, but going back to the point, so there were definitely some challenges during the hackathon. So when we announced on Friday night that, hey, this is you are required to have a trailblazer, which is what we call our young black males, and it's also very inclusive. We have girls who are part of that group, and you know we have Latinos who are part of that group, but primarily young black males. There were some people who left. There were some people who explained to me, they said, well, I don't see why that has to be a requirement, and which is interesting because in hackathons that are focused on women, for example, it doesn't make sense that at the end of a weekend that an all-male team will come up and pitch at a hackathon that's designed for women. And so so I just want to say that there definitely were some challenges during the hackathon. But some great apps came out of this hackathon, which was Help Circle, which is a social service. They were the first place winner, a social service that makes it easy to text a close friend or family when you are feeling unsafe. So they were really addressing that whole could an app have saved Trayvon Martin. And then this Court Date app, which was a second place winner, and they won the best business model, which was an SMS app that helps teens remember their court dates and avoid jail time for failure to appear in court. Which was really interesting because these developers, these designers, and our young people, because they were aware of how powerful text and SMS messaging is in these communities involving young black males, they built their apps around that.
Now, Kalima, you know I'm going to have to ask. Any stereotyping there? Any stereotyping at work there?
Yeah, I mean, I think they were really aware. I think some of the developers were, they just hadn't been aware of, they weren't aware that not all young black males have iPads. You know, like, I mean, that was just something that like they kind of just sort of woke up to. They said, oh, wow, you know, SMS text messaging. And they said, yeah, the flip phone. Yeah, they just weren't aware of what were the actual tools that were in their hands. And so, so I think that was something that, and so then they began to develop around that.
Okay, but they didn't develop an app so that they could remember their piano lessons, for example. I guess that's what I'm reacting to there. Why, you know?
Yeah, I think they were looking at what were some of the pressing issues and problems, and of course we had. So there was one app by, and they were our third place winner. And the People's Choice Award, it's called Connect the Dots, and it's a counseling social network for students of color who attend private schools to build community amongst themselves. And so, and it was really amazing because there was this young man who pitched it on Friday night, and he said, hey, and I'm a young man of color, and when I'm at private school, I feel lonely. And I think there needs to be something for us to help us connect to one another. And I think that would help us be better students and help us better connect to our school. And so those are kind of the solutions there. And there were 11 apps that were produced that weekend.
What was the vibe? What was the vibe like? I mean, again, particularly given that it started on what one might argue was a bit of a sour note in some respects, in the sense that people were expressing. On the other hand, honesty, you have to appreciate the honesty. If people said, I'm uncomfortable with this because I don't know anybody like this. This is not part of my world. And yet people came, anyway. So what was the vibe? I mean, did you feel this kind of sense of hesitation, or was it kind of jump right in? Or what was the atmosphere? Was it similar to other hackathons you've been a part of?
The vibe was very, the vibe was very village. If that makes sense, that there were a couple of people, I would say maybe 20 people at most, who definitely didn't think that this was the startup weekend that they expected, which was sort of the generic, homogenous environment of Silicon Valley hackathons. And so so they left. Okay, great. All right. You know, they got some food and they left. That's good. But for everyone else, it was a village environment. So even at the end, after the judging and we gave awards and all that, we actually had a rite of passage ceremony where all the trailblazers were on stage and everyone who was in the building were shouting positive affirmations to them to let them know that they're all winners. And so that was the environment. We got a tremendous amount of volunteers. Kaiser, Permanente, and Dropbox, last minute, they were able to provide us with laptops. And so that was the atmosphere that, and that's why people keep calling this hackathon amazing. I've heard magical. And I think it's because of that. It was because we actually, for something that is usually sort of technical, it actually became sort of in a village environment in just the weekend.
Where do you think you might go from here to build on this idea?
So my investors and advisors want to have a serious conversation with me. and so they, because they were involved, and that was really interesting. So going back to the whole village environment, they were involved, and they were planning to be there for maybe about 2 or 3 hours, but they end up staying the entire weekend, and then their wives also stayed the entire weekend, and then their husbands stayed the entire weekend, and so at the end, they kind of many of them pulled me to the side and said, Kalima, we have to do this again. We need to look at what Kino is doing and how we can make this, how we can spread this. And so I need to go back to the drawing board and think of how to make this possible again, you know. And so,
all right. Yeah. We'll keep us posted. Kalima Pryforce is co-founder of Kino Labs and an organizer of Startup Weekend Oakland, and we caught up with him in San Francisco. Thanks so much for joining us. Keep us posted.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
If you've ever used something like Google Maps or a GPS device, thank Roger Tomlinson. He's widely regarded as the father of GIS, that's Geographic Information Systems, the technology behind electronic maps. Roger Tomlinson died Sunday at the age of 80. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Adam Ragusa has this remembrance.
It's hard to overstate how important this British-born geographer was to his field, but when I interviewed him last year, it didn't feel like talking to the father of an industry, more like a puckish grandfather.
So when people call you the father of GIS, what do they mean by that?
It means I'm old.
Tomlinson was 27 when he went to work for an aviation company in Canada in 1960. Government aid workers there wanted to build pulp and paper mills for Kenya, which was just emerging from British colonial rule. Tomlinson's company had already done aerial surveys in Africa, so the Canadian government hired them to figure out the best location for timber plantations to feed the mills.
You sort of needed the right soil. Slope is important. You can't put plantations where you can't easily harvest them.
To think about all this at the same time, Tomlinson needed to build what he called a sandwich of the topographic and climate maps he had. At the time, this would have been done by printing the maps onto huge transparencies, stacking them on a light table, and then looking down through them. But this was an aid project for a developing nation. They didn't have the budget for that.
And so I thought, if we could turn a map into a bunch of numbers, and they map on top into another bunch of numbers and get the computer to compare those two bunches of numbers, then we've got something.
GIS is important because it gives us a tool for not just seeing where things are, but how things interact.
Will Cowart is the GIS specialist for the Water Authority in Macon, Georgia. He says looking at maps of pipes in a computer doesn't just let him see where the houses are above. He can watch the water move, something you couldn't do on a transparency.
So then we can start doing network analysis that says what happens if this line breaks, which individual customers are going to lose water if we close this valve.
Today, thousands of GIS professionals are in government and industry worldwide, and they're all walking in Roger Tomlinson's shoes.
Esri, the GIS software giant where Tomlinson was a consultant, says in a statement, quote, "He was an inspiration to generations of geographers, cartographers, scientists, and anyone who understood the importance of location-based analysis." For NPR News, I'm Adam Ragusea in Macon, Georgia.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
On this Valentine's Day, we have news that online dating has become even more efficient than ever, for better or for worse. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Christy Van Adder tried the online match service eHarmony.
It was just a lot of time of looking at people's profiles, and people write a lot.
Most importantly, she didn't find Mr. Right, despite spending over $250. Then a friend told her about an app called Tinder.
And this is just so quick and instant. It is a little bit like a video game because you can kind of be like, yes, yes, no, no.
The app lets you say yes or no to profile photos, swipe left, goodbye, swipe right, hello, and it's free.
I would definitely say that Tinder is dating on steroids.
Sean Dempy-Wolf has been using Tinder for a little over a year. It uses location to connect people, and it hooks up to your Facebook page, though no one on Facebook has to know. If you indicate you like a picture, the person can message you.
Everybody goes through phases of like using it actively and messaging people, and you go through another phase of just like using it compulsively and like not messaging anyone.
Dempy-Wolf says he met a woman and they dated for 5 months, but it didn't work out. Tinder claims to have over 6 million matches a day, and Dempy-Wolf says he finds solace in that.
You want the feeling that there are enough people that they're out there. Even if you're not going to meet any of your matches on Tinder in real life, the fact that they are there can give you a little bit of comfort.
Tinder also gives some people immediate comfort. The ability to instantly message someone nearby makes it perfect for short liaisons.
I guess I would call it more of a guaranteed hookup app than a dating app.
Kyle McCarthy, 24 years old, travels a lot for work. He isn't looking for a relationship, and he says he regularly finds women who aren't either.
You swipe right, and then if you get a match, it's like, hey, how's it going? You know, what do you like to do? I've had a lot of girls that are like, I like kissing and cuddling and nice beds, just like the weirdest crap, but it's more or less, you know, their subtle way of being like, so, do you want to get together?
McCarthy says this is how most of his friends use Tinder. In fact, Tinder is modeled like an older app called Grindr. Grindr was developed for the gay male community 5 years ago. Clinton Fain, an artist and technologist, uses it instead of hanging out in bars.
It's quicker, it's more efficient. The whole premise of going to a bar is to drink. And you don't have to necessarily drink to have sex now because there's technology.
But the efficiency of both Grindr and Tinder has actually driven some people to delete their accounts. Most recently, Olympic gold medal snowboarder Jamie Anderson, who said it was way too distracting. Others, like Corey Wesley, think these apps can get in the way of real intimacy.
You're almost on a search for the better thing. I always say that gay men have gay ADD, where they're like, oh, okay, I like that. Okay, that's pretty. But now I'm going to go to that next pretty thing.
Wesley deleted his Grindr account. Terry Kim, a professional recruiter, says she started to have the same feeling about Tinder.
I was using the same method that I used to recruit engineers to recruit my candidate for my mate.
And just like a recruiter with a lot of candidates for a job, she got fussier.
I just felt like I couldn't really decide on anyone, and I kept wondering who else was out there that would be really perfect. I realized that maybe the same people were doing that to me, the people that I was going on dates with.
Of course, it may be that Wesley and Kim would have these struggles regardless of the technology. Benjamin Carney is a social psychologist at UCLA who's studied the impact of the internet on relationships, and he points out that people have always looked for something better.
People who are going through bad times already look for alternatives. The internet just means there's more of them. So it does speed things up and maybe makes it easier to act on an impulse.
For some people, these apps are fun, but it isn't where they want to find true love. Take 24-year-old Kyle McCarthy, the guy who uses Tinder for quick hookups.
Hopefully I can find a relationship in an old-fashioned way, meeting somebody in an interesting setting that I could tell a story about down the line rather than, well, we were both online trying to find people and we found each other.
I guess true romantics will always be with us. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.